One of the interesting consequences of the successful adjuvant trials of trastuzumab is that by splitting out these patients, the overall role of anthracyclines in the adjuvant setting is now being questioned in both HER2-positive and HER2-negative disease. I met with Dr. Sandra Swain, the principal investigator of NSABP-B38, evaluating three anthracycline-containing regimens in patients with HER2-negative tumors, and she began our conversation by commenting on the fascinating evolution of this data.
We've always really loved the anthracyclines for breast cancer for at least the last 20 years, and for me, I know we were some of the first adapters at the NCI to be using anthracyclines in node-negative disease based on Steve Jones' work with the AC. And I remember, even to this day, that I would anguish over whether we should use anthracyclines in these patients because of the known cardiac toxicity. However, soon we realized that there is a benefit with chemotherapy in these patients, so it didn't seem to be such a significant problem. However, if you look at things now, we know that patients are living very long-term, and we still don't have an idea of the long-term cardiotoxicity. So I think that's a significant issue right there, is we're curing more patients, but we really don't know long-term effects in these patients. We know that the anthracyclines kill some of the myocardium, and it doesn't come back. I mean, that's absolutely clear. So I think that it is a significant problem, not only the anthracyclines with cardiotoxicity, but with leukemia, it's probably less than 1%, but it's still an issue for these patients. I think one of the things that's going to help us with alleviating cardiotoxicity is we're going to be treating less patients, hopefully, in the future. We overtreat right now probably by 70% of patients with node-negative disease, and I think tests like the Oncotype DX will really help with that in eliminating unnecessary treatment. However, we still have the patients that had node-negative disease that were typically treating with anthracyclines and node-positive disease also. So you've got a large proportion of patients that we are, at least for standard of care, treating with an anthracycline-based regimen. And I think that the cardiac toxicity of the anthracyclines is significant, even though it's said to be less than 1%. There is probably an increase in patients who have left-sided radiation, especially if the CT planning is not done, which is not done in some places. But even if it is done, you still can get some heart in the field with radiation. People say that the IMRT may decrease that or some other things, but it's still a consideration.
Can I just ask, in terms of the magnitude of the problem, particularly that came out at the last ASCO meeting, if a woman asked you who's going to get an adjuvant anthracycline regimen, 4 cycles, what's the chance that over the next 20 years, you know, I'm going to have a heart problem that I wouldn't have if I didn't have an anthracycline? Knowing that we don't have an exact answer, what's your best ballpark guess?
I really don't know what answer to give them. The data that was presented by MD Anderson did shed some light on that, showing that the patients who did get anthracyclines have more cardiac toxicity as they get older, but I don't honestly know a percent. So I don't usually give them a percent number for long term, because I think you have to take into consideration many things, the patient's own morbidity and other issues, issues of hypertension, family history, all those cardiac risk factors. So I really have a hard time giving a patient a number regarding that, though I am pretty convinced that it is increased over those patients who have never had an anthracycline. I think the data supports that.
I guess what was confusing was that they were reporting like 40% of women in the 65 to 70-year-old group who had heart failure 20 years later, and it was hard to figure out where to get the real number.
Well, I think that that's the problem. We don't know the real number, and also the definition of heart failure is difficult because there's a lot of talk now about diastolic dysfunction and what that means. So I haven't looked at all of her data that closely, the data that was presented at ASCO, to see if they considered those aspects of it. I think they just did a registry summary by looking at, maybe it was Medicare.
You know, yeah, I think it was Medicare. Yeah, it was.
So
Medicare.
They just looked at records. So you're not really looking at individual patients. So I think that they were looking at coding of heart failure. You know, I'm not sure what the number is. I just know, at least based on that, it is significant. It's probably not 40%. But in general, even in the population without getting anthracyclines, heart failure diagnosis is increasing.
Right. And I guess the other question, too, is do we really need anthracyclines? And I think since we started to break things out in terms of HER2 positive and HER2 negative, we're kind of getting a different picture of that. So let's start out with the HER2 negative situation. Do we have data to suggest anthracyclines really help in those patients?
I think a lot of the data up until Denny Slaman's recent data suggests that anthracyclines are necessary, but there are studies that do compare, for example, AC to CMF showing no difference in the adjuvant setting. But if you use a longer course of anthracyclines, it seemed to be more efficacious. So there are a lot of data supporting anthracycline use in the HER2 negative patients.
What about non-anthracycline regimens? And the one there's a lot of discussion about is the TC, docetaxel cyclophosphamide combination that Steve Jones in U.S. Oncology reported. What was your take on that?
I think that that was a very small study, 1,000 patients. It was node negative, node positive. I was very skeptical as to whether any results would come from it because it's a very underpowered study. However, you can't argue with the results that the TC had a disease-free survival benefit over AC, even though you had a lot of low-risk patients in that group. 500 or so were node negative. So it's clearly a positive study for TC. And, you know, Steve Jones has been the person who invented AC. So I think that he didn't have an axe to grind there. He really wants to find the right thing. I believe the data. I have actually started treating patients with that regimen.
What kind of patients?
I treat patients that have node negative disease or maybe node positive that are ER positive.
So the patients that maybe in the past year are given AC alone to?
Yes.
Interesting.
I have been using that.
You know, he had presented that it was better tolerated than AC, and some people were skeptical about that. What are you actually seeing?
Well, I've used docetaxel or Taxotere for a long time, so I have a lot of confidence in it. I've used 100 per meter squared quite often. I've used it in the adjuvant node-positive trial. So using 75 per meter squared with cyclophosphamide, I don't have a problem with, and the patients have done fine with it. I mean, they do fine, many of them, with 100 per meter squared. The other advantage to the TC is you don't need growth factors. And getting back to the issue of leukemia, I just read the JCO article on mitoxantrone, and really nice article looking at all the leukemia effects, so that's kind of why that's on my mind. And you probably are not going to get it with TC, and I think that's great also, because we certainly don't want to have these low-risk patients getting leukemia, or any patients getting leukemia. So with TC, there's the advantage of no cardiac toxicity, probably less leukemogenic effect because you're not using either an anthracycline or growth factors.
How are things going in terms of NSABP B38, and can you review that design and where you're at with that study?
NSABP B38 is a study that was very practical, comparing TAC chemotherapy to the dose-dense AC followed by paclitaxel given the 175 per meter squared every 2 weeks. And then the third arm was the AC paclitaxel with gemcitabine given every 2 weeks also. And we designed it this way because at the time we really wanted to put a biologic in, but there wasn't anything available. So we thought, well, what did people want to know? I mean, they want to know if TAC is better than dose-dense, or is dose-dense the be-all and end-all of things. And we wanted to make some progress and advance things, so we added in the gemcitabine based on Kathy Albane's data in metastatic disease. So that trial has been doing extremely well. The accrual has just been outstanding. In fact, I think last month we had 234 patients. So we're almost completed accrual. It will be completed in May, 4,800 patients.
And probably, how long did it take to get the 4,800 patients?
It's been about 2.5 years.
Wow.
So it was
amazing.
Way ahead of accrual.
Wow, incredible.
So to me, that says that people in the community and the academic community are interested in answering this question, because they did put their patients on, found it relatively well tolerated. If you look at the toxicity, the TAC chemotherapy had single-digit febrile neutropenia rate, which is surprising. It may have been due to pegfilgrastim rather than the GCSF, but it was less than on our previous study. I don't remember the current number, maybe 6 or 7% febrile neutropenia, which is pretty low.
That's with growth factors.
With PEG. Hmm. Most people are using PEG now. I mean, I don't have those numbers.
Sure.
But
when do you think you might have your first efficacy results?
I am not sure about that because I don't know the number of events exactly. We're predicting in 08 that maybe we'll have the first interim analysis, but that's always up in the air.
Now, are the patients stratified based on receptor status, or how are you going to look at the issue of receptor status?
They are stratified on receptor status, and they initially could have had HER2-positive disease. This was before all the Herceptin data came out, so we probably have a few patients. I don't know exactly how many that have HER2-positive disease, but very few.
So essentially, you'll be able to provide an answer to this randomization for both ER-positive, ER-negative tumors?
I hope so. Yes, because it was stratified for that.
Any predictions?
I predict that the dose dense will not be better than TAC therapy and that the gemcitabine arm may come out the best.
What do you think you'll see in terms of ER-positive tumors?
It may be equal. I think the reason I hesitate on that is because I think one of the reasons why TAC chemotherapy in the study that was presented had efficacy in those patients who had ER-positive disease was possibly because there was a higher rate of amenorrhea in those patients, and it may be a hormonal effect due to ovarian ablation. So I don't know what it is going to be with dose-dense chemotherapy or dose-dense chemotherapy with gemcitabine. If you look at the couple of studies that have compared ovarian suppression or ablation with dose-dense versus not, there was no difference. So it may be, I predicted that the gemcitabine would be better. It may be in ER-positive that the TAC may be better because you may have more ovarian suppression.
Interesting. And you just wrote a review article looking at amenorrhea in premenopausal patients with adjuvant chemo. Were there any sort of points in there that you thought were particularly important for oncologists to be aware of, new things that came out, for example? And I guess one of the things I wondered about was the implications of this whole scenario in terms of AIs and ovarian function and chemo, which is such a critical issue with the AIs.
In reviewing it, and we reviewed many, many studies, the studies that have come out more recently with a larger number of patients, and when they are subsetted to only include those patients who have ER-positive disease, and it looks like those patients who developed chemotherapy-induced amenorrhea had a better disease-free survival. I think that that's going to be what we're going to see. And in B30, we're asking that question, too, prospectively, so we'll have more data on that. In my practice, based on all I've done and reviewed, I actually have been ablating patients with an LHRH agonist if they're young and they have high risk. I know that there's no data on this whatsoever. There are three trials trying to answer this question, but I'm very concerned that the amenorrhea is very important or the stopping ovarian function is very important. Now, you asked about it in relationship to using AIs. If I have a patient, let's say a 40-year-old patient who I give TAC chemotherapy to, she becomes amenorrheic, which most will, with that chemotherapy, probably 90% or so, would I then give that patient an AI? I would not. I think that there are many reasons not to. One, just because a patient has amenorrhea doesn't mean they don't have circulating estrogens and having some ovarian function. And a recent article in the last year, I think it was by Smith, actually looked at, I think it was 25 premenopausal women that had developed amenorrhea and then were given an AI. And many of those women ended up either having menses returning on an AI, one got pregnant, and then I think one had biochemical measurements that indicated she was still premenopausal. And I, in my own practice, I've had at least two patients in the last few years who were late 40s, early 50s, who became amenorrheic with chemotherapy, and then their period started again 2 years later. So I absolutely would not give an AI to a patient who has stopped menstruating after chemotherapy unless, the only situation I would do it, unless I gave them also an LHRH agonist.
What about if they remain amenorrheic and biochemically postmenopausal for a couple years?
Probably for 2 or 3 years, then I would consider it.
You'd switch from tamoxifen to an AI?
Actually, if they were younger, if they were in their 30s or 40s, I would probably continue the tamoxifen for 5 years and then switch. We know that the estrogen production fluctuates over several years. So I think it's risky, and you may not get the benefit of the AI that you want if you've got these fluctuating estrogen levels.
So in what situations do you raise the issue or actually go ahead and recommend an LHRH agonist? You mentioned high risk. How high does the risk have to be?
Node positive.
as long as we're talking about studies and the NSABP, I'm curious about your thoughts about NSABP B40, the neoadjuvant trial. And I understand there's going to be a companion. That's for HER2-negative tumors, a companion study in HER2-positive tumors. Can you talk about those two initiatives?
NSABP B40 is a trial that's long been in the design. We've had many, many designs for this, but we were very convinced that we needed to have some kind of biologic study of these patients who are getting neoadjuvant treatment. So we really waited until we had the right design. The study is going to be a three-arm design in which patients will get docetaxel first with either capecitabine or gemcitabine, and then it's followed by AC chemotherapy. And one of the primary goals of this is really to see if looking at the gene or microarray analysis at baseline before the patients get any treatment will predict which patients respond. So it's really moving more into the 21st century here, trying to tailor treatment to see if we can predict response. In the study, the patients also will be randomized to get bevacizumab or not, so also trying to answer the biologic question there, too. In the HER2-positive patients, the patients will get, they've changed it so many times.
I guess the thing that I've heard consistently is it's, you know, lapatinib, trastuzumab, or both.
With paclitaxel.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the chemo.
Yeah, I don't remember the latest design.
Right. I guess, well, maybe we can just sort of broaden out a little bit. I know in the HER2-positive situation, there's an interest in looking at neoadjuvant lapatinib alone or combined with trastuzumab versus trastuzumab chemotherapy, I guess, to be determined. What are your thoughts about that study?
Well, I think it's, again, a study that's very interesting. It really goes hand in hand with the ALTO study, the adjuvant trial, using these three different arms plus one other one in the adjuvant setting. So I think it's very important. I think it's also going to be interesting to see if the pathologic complete response rates is good with lapatinib versus trastuzumab and if the combination makes any difference. So I think you'll have some answers very early there in this study. So I think that's why this is important. I think the CALGB is also doing a very similar study.
Right.
So we'll have some early answers about pathologic complete response, which may give us an indication of what's going to happen later in the adjuvant setting.
In terms of the B40 study there and looking at bevacizumab in the neoadjuvant setting, you've looked at that in women with inflammatory breast cancer. And then you had a more recent paper that came out in the JCO looking at some of the biologic issues.
The study we did in inflammatory breast cancer was a study giving bevacizumab alone for one cycle and then following that with chemotherapy and bevacizumab. It was a small pilot study. The whole goal was really to see if we could find molecular markers that would predict response to bevacizumab. So we, as I said, treated with bevacizumab alone, and we did biopsies before and after that. And we found that one thing consistently did decrease with treatment, and that was the activated VEGF receptor 2, or KDR. And this is the receptor through which VEGF-A acts to increase angiogenesis. So we found a decrease in activated receptor, and we also found decrease in permeability and flow by MRI. So we did find these changes that occurred with the drug alone. The other things we looked at were interesting, and apoptosis increased also, which was similar to what Jenny Chang has found with Herceptin. So it's interesting that these things were found with a biologic agent alone. Since it was a small pilot study, we didn't find any correlation to response because almost all the patients responded. So that was great for the patients, but there wasn't a big dichotomy there to really look at. I think what needs to be done is the activated receptor and apoptosis need to be looked at in larger studies, and they're going to be. And I know Dennis Slamon is doing a study with TAC, similar kind of study with or without bevacizumab. So hopefully he can also look at that. We looked at a lot of other things that I wouldn't recommend people look at in the future.
I guess the thing from my simplistic view of that struck me was I thought that the Bev was working on the stroma And yet it looked, from what you were saying, like maybe it's working against the tumor cells directly.
Well, I think really the interesting finding is that the VEGF receptor 2 was decreased in the tumor cells, and it was present so much in the tumor cells. Most of the literature, when we designed that study, Napo Ferrara had really written a lot of reviews and done a lot of research. Everything was geared towards these receptors and VEGF acting on the endothelial cells. Though a couple of papers had been published showing that they were present on tumor cells, it wasn't really felt to be a big mechanism of action. But I'm more convinced now that it's really the tumor cells that are important. I think stroma is important too, and especially in inflammatory cancer, but that's an aside. I think that the key finding was that it was the actual tumor cells, not the endothelial cells.
And you mentioned also the blood flow issue, but would that be necessarily the result of the BEV, or could it be the result of an anti-tumor effect?
It probably is not anti-tumor effect that early on, because...
So you saw it sort of right away?
We saw it right away, and the patients noticed it right away.
Huh. Yeah, I think you told me in the past that their breasts felt not as warm.
Right, well, less red. They all noticed it was less red.
That it became less red, yes. Like as soon as they got the BEV.
Well, shortly after, right.
Like so, how long after?
Within days.
Days.
So I doubt seriously it's an immediate anti-tumor effect. That may be related more to blood vessel flow.
And has that been seen in other studies?
Willett looked at it in rectal cancer and found that the interstitial pressure was decreased. I mean, it was a really elegant study. I don't know how they did it, but they did. They found that interstitial flow was definitely decreased. And I think one other group looked at it in breast cancer. And this is with bevacizumab. So I think that it may be related to that.
And now, of course, the NSABP is coming in. You're going to get, how many patients on this study?
For B40, I think it's 1,200.
Yeah, so that's going to be awesome to have that kind of data available, a huge amount. Another thing that came out in that inflammatory study that you did was the issue of wound healing after surgery. Can you talk about what you found and how the NSABP sort of took that in making this design?
We found in our patients in the inflammatory breast cancer trial with bevacizumab that 5 of the 13 patients who went on to mastectomy had wound healing problems, which in my experience, I've seen a lot of locally advanced inflammatory breast cancer. That's very high. We had seromas and incisional healing problems. And this is not surprising when you look at the data in rabbits. There is wound healing problems there. So what we've decided in the NSABP is to drop out the bevacizumab for the 2 cycles before surgery. Bevacizumab will still be around because it has a very long half-life. It probably takes 4 or 5 months for it to go away, but the levels will not be as high. So hopefully that will prevent any problems there. And we're also discouraging any kind of immediate reconstruction, which may be a problem for some patients. But I think it's better that they don't do that because the wound healing could be more of an issue in those patients.
Now, in your study of 13 patients, what was the interval from the BEV to the surgery?
The interval was about 4 to 6 weeks.
That's not...
It's very short.
Yeah, but I mean, people are talking about 6 weeks as being okay. Is that really okay?
Well, it's going to be more than 6 weeks. It'll probably be more like 9 weeks.
In the B40 study.
Right.
Right. Let's talk about the next adjuvant study for HER2-positive disease. And I know there's been discussions going on between the BCRG and the NSABP. The last I heard from John Mackey was we're doing TCH plus or minus BEV. Is that going to happen?
Our current plan is to do TCH plus or minus BEV. And we've had lots of heated discussions about this. But based on the BCRG-006 data that just came out, again, the second interim analysis showing essentially that TCH was very similar to the ACTH, people are feeling much more comfortable now without using anthracyclines. And also the TOPO2 data kind of fell apart there too. So we're going ahead at the moment. In fact, I'll be talking at our meeting in April about the design. I have the protocol with me. Just got it. And we're going to go ahead with that. We are planning also to include in their ACTH being Taxotere or docetaxel H plus or minus BEV for those groups or physicians who choose to do that, who feel that they need to use an anthracycline. Now, the NSABP will not allow that, nor will the BCIRG, because those groups will be doing the TCH plus or minus A. However, there are some groups in Europe that are planning to do the ACTH A plus or minus A part of it.
So when you see a patient with node-positive, HER2-positive disease who's not going to go on a protocol right now, what in general are you using in terms of chemo, and what were you doing 2-3 months ago?
I was using AC, weekly paclitaxel 8 is what I used on all the patients. Based on the 06 data, I would feel very comfortable using TCH. Very comfortable, and
very
probably
comfortable
would do that.
Or that's
I
likely,
would do it.
Yeah. So you've kind of made that leap.
Yes.
There are a lot of people. I'm not sure whether the majority. I'd say it's the majority of clinical investigators or not. We had a think tank a few weeks ago, and there was definitely some still anthracycline people there. So I think people are still kind of mulling that over. Matter of fact, Edith Perez is still using anthracycline. Do you think that a year from now people are not going to be using anthracyclines?
I hope that's the case, because I think the anthracycline cardiotoxicity is a big issue. Even though it was fairly low in the 06 study, it's still not zero. So I think more and more people will be moving over to that, especially when they see the TOPO2 data.
There are people, including Edith, who says, well, this presentation December 2006 was a, quote, interim analysis, and there's one more, quote, final analysis, and she wants to wait for that. I've heard other people say, no, it's not going to change. This is the answer. How do you see it?
I hope it doesn't change. I mean, anything could happen. The likelihood, though, that it'll change is pretty low. So I'm convinced about it. The first interim analysis didn't show a significant difference in any case anyway, and the TCH also benefited patients. So it's not really so different. It's just showing that they're more and more equal, the two, ACTH and TCH. And I think when you look at the cardiac toxicity and the morbidity of that in these patients, and the fact that you can get such a benefit from either one, I really think that the benefit of using TCH outweighs any potential risk of having less efficacy.
A woman says to you, what's my chance of developing a serious cardiac problem by taking this TCH as opposed to not taking it at all? What number would you give her?
Very low, almost zero. When you use Herceptin alone, you don't have cardiac toxicity. There was some on the TCH arm. There were some clots and different arrhythmias and things like that. But I think that it's really heart failures. Just about zero.
You had mentioned leukemia, too, and that was another thing that was presented. Can you comment on that?
Very, very small numbers.
I guess something just to sort of think about a little bit.
Right. Well, and it is a big issue. I think you'll see less with the TCH arm, but really, truly, the numbers were small at this point.
What about the issue if you are going to use an anthracycline as to whether or not there's a difference between docetaxel or paclitaxel? Dennis Slaman claims that there's a little bit less cardiac toxicity if you use docetaxel through indirect comparisons. Do you buy into that?
Not really. I think that some of the definitions of heart failure are different in the studies, but I'm not sure there really is a difference. And if you look at the 1199 data, I think you could use either one. You can use a weekly paclitaxel or the Q3 week docetaxel in the adjuvant setting, and either one is fine. So I think either one is okay. And we don't really have other data on the AC docetaxel age, so we'll just leave it there.
What are your thoughts about adjuvant trastuzumab in the patient with node-negative disease? There's a lot of debate about the issue of the patient with a tumor or a centimeter or less. What are your thoughts about it?
That's a very difficult area because there are so few patients that have been treated that are less than a centimeter. On the adjuvant trials, the only trial that allowed those patients was the BCIRG trial, and there were probably only about 50 patients randomized, something like that. So there's really no data in this group of patients. The way I look at it is if they have a tumor less than a centimeter and their tumor's HER2 positive, I will talk to the patient about adjuvant Herceptin. Now, if it's 2 millimeters or 1 millimeter or just a microscopic microinvasion, I usually will discourage the patient. I don't have any hard set rules on it, but if everything looks bad, if it's 5 millimeters, grade 3, HER2 positive, ERPR negative, I will more strongly recommend Herceptin in that patient.
Are there situations where you would consider adjuvant trastuzumab without chemotherapy? And, of course, the situation that's been considered is the patient, the ER positive, older patient who might not do well on chemo.
Well, you kind of answered that question. I think that would be the only kind of patient that I would consider it, but I personally feel that there's synergy between the chemotherapy and the Herceptin, so I would go with what the studies have shown using with chemotherapy. So that's my first choice. If you really have someone who has a lot of morbidity and you really think cannot tolerate any chemotherapy, then I would consider it. But if you look at the Tandem trial, those patients who got the AI that had HER2 positive tumors, ER positive, had a terrible disease-free survival. I mean,
That was a metastatic disease.
Yeah, they are not disease-free. Time to progression. Time to progression was really short. And you would expect a patient that had ER-positive disease to have a longer time to progression. Well, they didn't. So I think they've got a poor prognosis anyway. And that study really made me think maybe, you know, I shouldn't be so sanguine in the metastatic patients that have HER2-positive disease. I haven't been treating them initially with Herceptin. I've been using hormonal therapy and waiting and hoping to get some mileage out of that. But if you actually look at that data, it really indicates we need to rethink that.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation the issue in terms of predictors of response and prognosis, and you read an editorial in the JCO that went along with a publication on Oncotype DX with the B20 data. Can you talk a little bit about what that study looked at and some of the thoughts that you've expressed in that editorial?
B20 was a study in which patients who had ER-positive, node-negative disease were randomized to tamoxifen versus chemotherapy and tamoxifen. And as you remember, that study showed a benefit from the addition of chemotherapy in all patients, and with the latest analysis mostly in the premenopausal women. The Oncotype DX looked at those patients who got the chemotherapy versus not, and found that those patients who had the high recurrence score benefited from chemotherapy, whereas those that had the lower recurrence score did not benefit from chemotherapy. And I think that this, to me, is an outstanding contribution, because I now have adapted using Oncotype DX in all my patients that have ER-positive, node-negative disease that's HER2-negative. So I use it in all those patients. I found it to be very helpful. And I even had a male breast cancer patient, which I don't know if you want to hear about it, but
yeah,
it was
definitely
a really interesting case.
Tell me about it. That's interesting.
He had a 1-centimeter tumor. And as you know, most patients with male breast cancer have very highly ERPR-positive tumors, and he did. And it was node-negative, which is also unusual. Most of the patients have node-positive disease. So it was really something you'd think, okay, 1 centimeter, very ERPR-positive.
HER2-negative.
HER2-negative. In the past, no question you would just give hormonal therapy to this person. Because we had decided to use the assay in all these patients, and this was at the Naval Hospital, we did an Oncotype DX in him, and his recurrence score was 37. So it really gave me a lot more information to treat this patient, and so he got chemotherapy, and I feel much more confident that I'm doing the right thing in this patient. So I think that's just illustrative of how helpful it can be in patients. Usually it's probably the other direction, in that you think that maybe you should give chemotherapy, you wring your hands, should, you know, this recurrence maybe 10%, it's going to help the patient. So usually it's that way more that you end up having a low recurrence score, because about half of them are actually low recurrence score, so it prevents treatment.
It's interesting. Again, we tend to think about avoiding chemotherapy as a consequence of this, and yet there are situations where people get treated and hopefully they're going to have a 75% relative reduction. I guess that number is not totally fixed in stone at this point, but that was what was seen in the B20 study, to my read.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you're routinely using this in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative tumors. What about the larger tumors, 2 to 3 or even bigger than 3?
If they have node-negative disease, I would do the Oncotype DX, because I think it's all about the biology and not the size particularly.
So you'd be okay with not giving chemo to a patient with a 3.5, 4-centimeter tumor that had a low recurrence score?
I would, absolutely.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you one other thing about Oncotype. I'm curious about this other genomic assay, the mammoprint, that I guess is just becoming available. Can you talk about what that is and how that compares to Oncotype?
I'm really concerned about that. I don't understand why the FDA approved that, because it's not validated. In fact, in the MINDAC study, they're trying to validate it. It's really never been validated. It's just been used in a couple of studies, and the patients were treated differently not like with the Oncotype, where it was from one study, a prospective study, where you have comparisons of treatment. So I can't see a use for it right now.
I guess the other issue, my understanding, is you need fresh tissue.
Well, that's a big problem.
So I guess if you look at the two initiatives right now that are evaluating it, you have the MINDEX study that's, I think, comparing the mamma print to Rabdin's online. And then you have the TAILOR-RX study that ECOG and Joe Sperano is doing, focusing on Oncotype. What are your thoughts about those two studies?
Well, I think the TAILOR-RX study is interesting because of the study design. It's all the cooperative groups in the U.S. shows you that the investigators are convinced that the Oncotype DX works because they're not treating the low risk and they are treating the high risk. It's the intermediate group where the data was fuzzy. Those patients are the ones that are being randomized. So I think it's a good study. I think it's going to be hard to convince patients to be randomized. I know they have about 600 patients or more on that study right now, and I'm not sure how many were randomized. So I think it's important, extremely important, and we will gain further information from these low and high risk groups also. Now, the MINDAC is basically using your clinical judgment using Rabdin's adjuvant online versus the mammoprint to see if either one will predict which patients benefit. So again, as you said, it requires fresh tissue. It's going to be about 4,000 patients that are in that group that will be randomized to use one assay or the other.
Are you planning on putting patients on TAILOR-RX?
I would definitely like to do that.
How do you think the randomization of chemo versus not is going to work out?
I think it's going to be difficult because I think that patients are so knowledgeable now that they are really going to have a hard time being randomized.
Yeah, it's a real interesting thing to try to contemplate. You know, put yourself in the position of the patient. How would you feel about randomization to chemo? I mean, obviously, there are tons of trials that have somehow done that. You wonder how they got done exactly.
In the past, though. Now there's so much more data showing a benefit.
Right.
Survival from breast cancer is increasing. You know, think people are doing better. So patients, I'm sure, have a lot of skepticism about whether they should not get chemotherapy. So I would think, and physicians, I think there's a physician mindset.
Yeah.
And patients end up seeing a lot of different physicians, surgeons, and other people who feel that adjuvant chemotherapy is beneficial. So I think that it's going to be really hard to randomize that intermediate group. You know, this is a different day and age. There's so much information out there that it's really hard. 20 years ago, it was much easier to randomize patients because most patients didn't want chemotherapy. They didn't know chemotherapy benefited. Now we know it benefits. I think the other important thing that's come out with this Oncotype is looking at estrogen receptor specifically. And I know there were some posters at San Antonio that looked at that. And I think that the RT-PCR may be the best way to measure estrogen receptor. I think that we need to look at that because we know immunohistochemistry is fraught with problems. You could have false negatives, false positives, and, you know, I'm really uncomfortable when I get an estrogen receptor assay from a small laboratory. And that makes a huge difference for the patients if you're really discriminating how you treat them based on one immunohistochemical assay for estrogen receptors. I think we need to really look at that. We are looking at that and may see that the RT-PCR will be the way to look at ER in the future.
Here's an interesting case in that regard that Bill Harwin, who's the head of the Florida Cancer Specialist Group in Naples, sent me an email about a patient who had an, quote, ER-positive, node-negative tumor that he sent for Oncotype. And the Oncotype people contacted him and said, this patient's ER-negative. And it was like a small tumor, like I think it was 0.8 centimeters. And he sent the tissue to Craig Allred and said, yeah, this is ER negative. Now the woman's on TC. And he wasn't even contemplating that. That really shocked me because I was much more tuned into the issue of false negative and missing people that we might treat. This was interesting because it ended up the patient got chemo. She never would have gotten chemo. That makes sense?
Yeah, it definitely does. But if you know much about immunohistochemistry, with all the antigen retrieval methods, they pull up so many antigens that false positives are probably more common than false negatives. And that's the same with HER2. So, you know, in Mike Press's data with HER2, 20% or so are probably false positive. So it's not surprising. And that's why it scares me to think of just using IHC now, when especially seeing the data that was presented at San Antonio.
Yeah, also the quantitation of it I thought was fascinating, mm-hmm. and how much variation the Oncotype was able to detect in the ER. And yeah, they had, like Steve Shack was showing me, these sort of cluster diagrams.
Right.
And if you've seen them, you know,
yes.
Where you see the three major subtypes breaking out on their plots. I want to ask you about another development related to ER-positive disease that I see a pretty striking change in, and that's the way people perceive the long-term natural history that's come out of the studies like MA17 that utilize delayed aromatase therapy. I'm just kind of curious what your take is on that in terms of following patients and deciding when to make an intervention, how long since they had tamoxifen. Suppose somehow they escape getting endocrine therapy for whatever reason. Do you start it 5 or 10 years later? What's your take on all that?
Well, I think it is really interesting, and it's so great that people are studying things so long term now, and we have all this data. As you're alluding to, that the patients with the ER negative disease recur early, and you see the chemotherapy benefit, I think, because they have higher proliferative tumors and they recur early, whereas the ER positive tend to recur somewhat evenly over time, or maybe even increase later on, or even 20 years later have a recurrence. So it's very different recurrence pattern. And I think you really do have to think about whether you should start these patients who have escaped from getting hormonal therapy on hormonal therapy. If the patient has a low-risk node-negative tumor, I usually don't even consider starting them on hormonal therapy. But if it's a higher risk and for some reason they never got it, I actually have done it recently, not recently, a few years ago. Patient had had a lot of positive nodes and for some reason, well, she got tamoxifen and 2 or 3 years passed and then the data was starting to come out. And I actually started her on letrozole, even though it was 2 or 3 years later, because she had many positive nodes. So I felt like the benefits really outweighed any risk of toxicity. At least right now, the main toxicity we're seeing are the arthralgias, which can be bothersome to the individual patient. We haven't seen long-term toxicity. Maybe we don't know what it is yet. There's some little bit of suggestion with the letrozole study that there may be some cardiac toxicity or cardiac events increased with the use of letrozole, and I think we have to watch that very carefully.